Hello and welcome to the first episode of the Sudan Elections podcast series, Voting for Change. From the Rift Valley Institute, I am your host, Raja Makkawi. The Sudan Elections Project is a short-term study on the history of elections in Sudan, particularly the 2010 and 2015 election. The research, published in a series of five briefing papers and a report, aims to examine the drivers and constraints that have shaped the course and consequences of previous elections in Sudan. It also draws out lessons to inform the programming and advocacy of actors working to ensure a successful transition in post-revolution Sudan. The current transition period in Sudan is pegged to the upcoming elections. Its success is defined by a peaceful and legitimate transition of power delivered through adult suffrage and secret ballots at the polls. However, the electoral history of Sudan invites skepticism, partly due to the likeliness of elections being used as a tool for authoritarian rule. In this podcast series, we discuss, among other things, election models adopted in Sudan's modern history. We examine why and how special votes were extended for farmers in the past, why graduates have sometimes had an extra vote, and why some systems seem to make it very hard for women to be elected. We will also discuss key choices available for policymakers involved in election design. Let's turn now to our guest, Justin Willis, Professor of Modern African History at Durham University. Professor Justin's research work is largely concerned with identity, authority, and social change in Eastern Africa over the last 200 years. He has recently completed work on a major ESRC-funded comparative history of elections in Kenya, Ghana, and Uganda. Thanks for joining us, Professor Justin. Can you tell us why does it matter which electoral system is used?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, we understand, I think we all share the idea that the ideal is that one person should have one vote. Okay, that sounds straightforward. But actually, how those votes are counted really matters. It makes a lot of difference. You can see that already with a presidential vote, where the choice is for the leader of a country as a whole. Can the presidential vote be won with a plurality? That is, do you elect as president someone who gets more votes than anyone else, but who still doesn't get a majority of votes across the country? Or do you say, no, the president has to have a majority of the vote, in which case you probably have to have an electoral system which has the capacity for two rounds, where in the first round there might be a number of candidates, none of whom gets an overall majority of votes, and then you have a second round where only the top two candidates stand, and one of them has to emerge with an overall majority. So already for a presidential election, you can see there are choices to be made about the electoral system. But it gets much more complicated when it comes to a parliament or a national assembly. That is, when you're thinking about who are the people who are going to be chosen from across the country to represent the will of the people. Because there are very different ways of doing that, and they each have advantages and disadvantages. And one of the things that must be decided in Sudan is which of these systems or which combination of them is going to work best for the coming elections. It's an important decision and it's worth thinking about carefully. So there's a relatively straightforward choice to make between, do you have a parliamentary system, which is fundamentally a national election where you count up everybody's votes all over the country and you just divide up the seats among the parties according to how many seats they got nationally? Or do you divide up the country into constituencies and have what is in effect a mini election in each constituency for a representative from that particular place? Do you have an electoral system that allows people to make a first vote, but they also have a second and sometimes even a third vote, what's called a transferable vote or an alternative vote system? Those are quite common in some parts of the world. On the whole, systems that are proportional representation, that is, that add up all the votes and then divide seats, or that are alternative votes, are arguably more representative or fair because all votes count. And in the case of alternative voting systems, even your second choices can count. But those systems are more complicated. They tend to rely on organized political parties. And most of all, they require quite a lot of popular trust in the system because they're sometimes quite hard to scrutinize from outside. So there is a really important question to be answered about which kind of system will be used in Sudan. And probably in the Sudanese context, we can leave out the idea of alternative votes because there's no real history of those. And this is going to come down to a question of constituency votes with what's called a first-past-the-post system, where the country is divided up into constituencies, or some kind of proportional representation where votes from all over the place get added together. That's going to be the decision, which of those or what combination of those should be used for the National Assembly or parliamentary elections. That's a really big choice.
So just now you mentioned, as well as in the History of Sudan Elections report, the term first past the post constituencies. Can you explain to our listeners what the term means and what are the advantages and disadvantages of it?
So first past the post constituencies, that's a sort of classic electoral model. It's the one that comes out of the United Kingdom. It's still used in the United Kingdom and in many other places. And what happens under that system is the country is divided up into constituencies. In each of those constituencies, there is an election. The person who wins the most votes in that constituency is elected as representative of it. Now, the advantages of that kind of system are that, first of all, people know who they're voting for. Constituencies can be quite big, but they're never that big, you know, so 70,000, 100,000 people. People can identify a sense of who the candidates are as individuals and get a sense of who they're voting for. That kind of system is also perhaps useful in that it can work for independent candidates, people who are locally popular or have a local profile. A further advantage is that the results of first past the post elections tend to be quite straightforward. The counting process is very simple because you're just counting the votes within a single constituency. They can be reported fairly straightforwardly, and the outcome is pretty obvious to everyone involved because there are very few numbers involved. Now, the disadvantages of first past the post constituencies are, however, multiple. The first is that dividing up the country into constituencies is already a complicated thing, and it can be a very controversial process. Exactly where you draw the boundaries of the constituencies can be a matter of considerable local interest and local pride. It can also, of course, be a way that people in authority can rig and manipulate elections by making constituencies a little larger or a little smaller to exclude or include particular groups whose votes might be considered desirable or indeed undesirable from a government's point of view. So demarcation is always a bit controversial. It can be quite difficult to do, and it can be an area where rigging is involved very directly. There are other disadvantages to constituency first-past-the-post systems too. In any constituency, a lot of the people who vote basically will feel that their votes are wasted, because if you vote for any of the candidates who don't win, you don't get your choice. You can feel like, well, my vote didn't count because the person from the other party lost. And especially because first-past-the-post systems almost always work on a plurality, that is, the person with the most votes wins. It's often the case that those elected don't have an overall majority, even in their constituency. If you have, say, 100,000 people in the constituency and 40,000 people vote for Mohammed and 30,000 vote for Idris, 25,000 vote for Fatima and 5,000 vote for Arub, then the candidate who gets the most votes will be elected, but they won't have been voted for by a majority. And the people who voted for everyone else might be unhappy. There's also a problem with first past the post, and it can encourage a very local view of politics. So candidates can run effectively as sort of delegates from their particular area, appealing perhaps to very local, ethnic, or sectarian interests, seeing themselves and presenting themselves to voters as the people who are going to fight the corner for their particular constituency. Now, that can be, of course, very useful. It can be a good thing. But it can also mean that the parliament just turns into a kind of haggling ground between delegates sent by different groups, each of whom wants the most for their particular constituency. So it can mean that the people elected can be discouraged from taking a national or collective view because they feel that they are the delegates of a local population and nothing more than that. There's also another problem, quite a big one. Historically, in Sudan, and actually many other parts of the world, women have been very unsuccessful in first-past-the-post elections. The way that local societal dynamics work, the way that public politics have worked, women have found it very difficult to win election in this kind of system. It's not just true of Sudan, it's true of many other countries across Africa and also across the world. First past the post systems have tended on the whole to favour men. Now, it is possible to overcome that. You can, for example, decide that as a political party, you might say, we're only going to put up women candidates in all the seats in which we're putting up candidates. And that's been done by some parties in various parts of the world over the years as a way of getting women elected in first past the post systems. But that does rely on quite a lot of party discipline. So there are multiple disadvantages as well as multiple advantages to first past the post. It's less fair, but it's perhaps more transparent and simpler.
So it's safe to say that Sudan's election system availed different rights to different constituencies. Is this why some people prefer proportional representation systems?
Absolutely so, Roger, yes. One of the reasons why people often prefer proportional representation is that in principle, it's basically fairer because everyone's votes get counted. And it's often easier for women and others to get elected through PR systems because they're easier to arrange and control to ensure the election of women. So PR systems often attract people for those reasons. The fairness, the ability to get women elected, those are big advantages. And just to kind of explain, perhaps for those who are not familiar with PR systems, in its very simplest form, a PR system works like this. You count up all the votes. You say, okay, there are 3 million votes for this party, 2 million votes for that party, 500,000 votes for that party. You divide up the number of seats in the National Assembly and you allocate them according to those proportions. Parties have to draw up a list of candidates in advance of the election with a ranked order of those candidates. So if you win 30 seats through the process, then the top 30 candidates on your list get elected to Parliament. So, of course, that's something that you can use to ensure women's representation, for example, because you can say that all of the top 50 candidates on your list will be women. So it's possible to use PR systems to ensure women's representation. And they are fundamentally, in principle, fairer and more representative. Under a first-past-the-post system, if you vote for a losing candidate, you feel like my vote didn't count. Under a proportional representation, PR system, you feel always that your vote has been counted. It's somehow gone into the mix in determining who sits in Parliament. Those, of course, are reasons why PR has been used across the world. Those are also reasons why, in the elections under the National Congress Party, there was a PR element to those elections. In the 2010 and 2015 elections, there was a significant PR element to the process. There was a women's list and there was also a separate party list. Both of those actually operated on a party basis. Parties nominated candidates to each of those lists, but the women's list was exclusively for women. The party list was, in theory, mixed, but was in practice pretty much all men. There are other advantages to PR systems as well, which have also been suggested in Sudan as elsewhere in the world. They tend to discourage the kind of localism that I was describing earlier. You can't win a national PR election by appealing to a very, very local group or constituency or special interest. And as a result of that, elected members of a National Assembly are much less likely to spend their time dealing with requests from their constituents to build a school in their place or to find jobs for people from their place, because there isn't that kind of very localized linkage. So that can be an advantage. It can also, though, be a disadvantage, because PR also has significant disadvantages. From the way I've described the way the system works, you can already see that it tends to rely on strong party structures. Parties have to campaign across the country. They have to create lists of candidates from whom the elected will be chosen. That means you really need strong party structures for PR system to work. It also, of course, means that parties with strong structures tend to do well out of PR systems. If, for example, you've got a very localized party or you haven't got a party at all, you're not going to do well in a proportional representation system, because those who can campaign in a coordinated way across the country will do better under proportional representation. That could be a good thing, of course, because you could say, okay, political parties are probably on the whole a benefit. A system that encourages strong political parties is a good thing. But especially at a stage when there aren't many political parties, or where there's one political party which is particularly strong and others are very weak institutionally, that can be a real problem. because it can build in an advantage for the institutionally established, which might actually be unfair in multiple ways. An advantage of PR is that it removes the localism. That's also potentially a disadvantage. It's the localism that often encourages people to participate in elections, to turn out and vote. Feeling that they know the candidate, feeling that the candidate is going to stick up for them, is something that makes people want to vote. So actually, a lot of people turn out and cast their ballots because they sort of want a delegate. And that might be problematic in terms of national politics, but it does ensure political participation. There's an interesting example of this in modern South Africa. The South African constitution is very much a PR-based one. The electoral system works around proportional representation, and that's kind of very fair in all sorts of ways. But there's a problem in that people often don't feel they have any link to their representative, because the representative isn't necessarily from their area, isn't necessarily anything to do with them. And that has tended to drive down participation rates in South African elections. So you have a system that's fair, but also somehow puts people off. Another problem with PR is that it can seem unclear in terms of results, particularly where systems are not very good at making results or systems clear, and where the electoral system has not been well explained or understood by the population. The counting and calculation of seats under PR systems can seem pretty obscure. The Sudanese system, for example, the one used in 2010 to 2015, didn't operate at a national level, it operated at a state level. So there was a PR contest within every state. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but because the results were never fully announced from those PR elections for any of the states, and because the calculation of the allocation of seats wasn't fully explained or announced, there was a widespread and quite possibly accurate suspicion that the system was being manipulated to favour the ruling party. And it is very apparent that the NCP dominated the PR elected seats in the National Assembly even more than it dominated in the constituency first past the post systems. So the ruling party in Sudan did very well out of PR in the past, partly because of the entrenched advantages that big parties, organised parties get, perhaps also partly basically because they cheated a little bit. It's very hard to tell because we don't have the full results, as I say, so you just can't say. That in itself, though, is a problem, of course, because PR systems tend to rely on trust. People have to believe in the system. They have to feel they understand the system. It's working for them. If they don't, then PR systems very rapidly lose the confidence of the people. And because they lack that sort of local linkage, that can lead to low participation, skepticism, and a lack of legitimacy of governments elected through it. So PR, lots of advantages in terms of fairness and representation, but also disadvantages, a bit more complicated, perhaps tending to be a little bit more obscure, less transparent, and reducing local linkages. Now, in the past, Sudan has combined these two systems. In 2015, the National Assembly was essentially elected half and half between first past the post and PR. That's certainly an option to be considered, and it's something that works very well across the world. But whatever balance is struck between these two systems, the decision should be taken through thinking about what are the advantages and disadvantages of each of them. What can they deliver? What do they bring to the electoral system? It's an important choice, and it needs to be considered carefully.
So what I'm hearing is that Sudan's election system has many similarities with the rest of the world. However, some of its characteristics are distinctive to local and national politics, such as its experimentation with graduate votes and sectoral votes. How did that work?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, Rajai, because you're absolutely right. In lots of ways, the system used in 2010, 2015 looked a lot like systems internationally do. But Sudan has a sort of deeper history of experimentation with forms of representation, which continues to echo or cast a shadow over electoral discussions. And it's worth thinking about that because it shapes the political context. So you mentioned, for a start, graduate votes. For those who don't remember this system in Sudan, which would most of the population now, the graduate votes were first introduced in the 1950s, actually, but they reappeared in the 1960s and again in the 1980s, in the period of parliamentary elections and rule then. And basically what this meant was that people with a certain level of education got extra votes. special constituencies were created in which graduates got to vote a second time. So they could vote in the first past the post constituencies, and then they got to vote a second time for special graduates representation. And there were people who sat in the parliament who were graduates representatives. Now, the logic for this was very straightforward, and it was that people who have education understand the system and understand politics better, and therefore it is fitting that they should have more representation in the National Assembly. That might maybe sound a bit shocking because it's kind of elitist and unfair, but it was also, of course, based in a sense among many particularly educated people in Sudan that the votes of the uneducated would be swayed by ethnic, tribal, sectarian interests, and that Sudan really needed the additional input of educated voters to provide a voice for what was seen as a more progressive or modern constituency. And those were terms that were used at the time. So people argued for graduate votes basically by saying that one person, one vote is fine, but there's a real danger that's just going to be dominated by tribal sheikhs or by local religious leaders. What we need is another extra form of representation that will give a voice to the educated. That was why it was that there were these graduate seats, and that's why they kept coming back under parliamentary system, because of a fear amongst the educated that parliament would be hijacked by what they saw as unprogressive forces. That's what drove that along. And I think there's still echoes of that in Sudanese politics, in the way still that educated people sometimes talk about the uneducated or about the dangers of ethnic voting or sectarian voting. That still echoes in the way people think about politics in Sudan. There's another kind of strand to that sort of special voting thing, which was very apparent in the Nimeiri period. Now, Nimeiri was very fond of elections, although he always made sure he wasn't going to lose them. But he liked elections because he saw them as a way of mobilizing people, of getting people to participate. And in his thinking, and it should be said in the thinking of many people around him, Nimeiri was not alone in this. What Sudan needed wasn't just extra votes for the educated, it was also votes for people who worked in particular sectors, because the idea was that particular kinds of work, particular economic sectors, needed representation in the National Assembly. So it wasn't just a matter of one person, one vote. There should also be special seats for farmers or for engineers or for doctors. The idea being that as professional groups, they needed a voice to articulate the specific concerns which related to their group. So that was why in the Nimeiri years, you had these kind of sectoral elections. Quite often, not many people took part. And in some ways, they just turned into another way for the Sudan Socialist Union to cement its dominance over the parliamentary system. But again, they reflect a sort of enduring idea that there might be alternative forms of representation. I'm not suggesting that this is what Sudan needs for the future, by the way. This is something very much for Sudanese people to decide for themselves. But what I'm pointing to is the fact that Sudan has a history of experimentation with different forms of representation. And that has often reflected somewhat elitist ideas about how certain groups should have a particularly loud voice. And it's quite likely that those ideas might be in circulation again in the coming discussions about how and why people should be voting in the future. So people should bear in mind that deeper history as they come into these discussions.
That's wonderful, Professor Justin. That's all we have time for today. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be coming back with a second episode featuring Professor Manzoor Al-Asal of Khartoum University. Stay tuned. This podcast is produced as part of the Sudan Elections Project, a Rift Valley Institute Sudan research program funded by the British Council. It was hosted by Rajat Makari and edited by David Meffey.